lost a sea of crippled pain, seen a world go up in flame, found another chance to change.
About that song,
man, that was at the very low point for me in my life, and I just crossed the sea of crippling pain. It was after my first wife passed away, and I was just like, okay.
What year was that, Kip?
96. I was working on that album before she passed away, and then I had to finish it after she passed away. So there's a few songs on there that are only one word and stuff that were, I was kind of addressing that, and that was, so I was it was really like an album of just, you know, like a personal diary, cathartic to write the songs. That was just like, hey, here I am. This is my cross to bear, basically. It's interesting because I went to Egypt at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time there, about three and a half weeks right after that, which was a really interesting time. And I wrote part of the words, probably most of those words, when I was in Egypt. And which was interesting because they worship the dead, right? So I was in there at that time, super spiritual awakening, so to speak, for me personally there. I'm not a religious person, but I lean on the spiritual side. And I really took away a lot from being there that had a huge influence on that album.
I started getting into your solo records really after I saw you play solo. And then I went and got your solo records.
Yeah, thanks.
And was blown away.
It's a whole different thing. When I did my solo records, I was like, okay, no screaming, no heavy guitars. I wanted to rewrite my own kind of doctrine about how to do an album.
Yeah.
And I changed my compass, like, okay, who am I listening to for this? Gabriel. And kind of, I was really into early Euro poppy weird stuff like Ultravox.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
And so that had a huge influence on me when I was a kid, and I kind of like pulled some of those weird sounds into my solo thing, very experimental stuff. And it was very creative time for me because I was trying just to completely reinvent myself, Even though I knew nobody was gonna buy the album. I do a lot of interviews where I try to make the point that money screws up art. If you're doing it for the money, for me, and I can't speak for anybody, maybe it's not the same for everybody, but for me, if I know I'm making money on something, or if I get, it's really even difficult to get a commission, because it's like, then you have to kind of, oh my God, what do I have to deliver here? It's much more discipline for me if I'm just pure in the music. And back in the day when it was like the record company would be like, you don't have any hits, you know? And so we went through all of that. And after that time, I was like, okay, I'm only going to write for myself, and someone out there is going to dig it, because there's 9 billion people on the planet and somebody's got to like it. And if they don't, hey, whatever, you know?
Okay. Before we go on, I want to talk a little bit about Kip. We've known each other since, I'd say, 2002 or so. I met him here in Atlanta when he was doing a solo guitar show playing his own arrangements of Winger songs that were completely beautiful, like the opening tune that you heard. They were all reharmonized, and I was blown away. I mean, really, I couldn't believe it. And Kip is a really serious classical composer. He's written a ballet entitled Ghost. It was premiered by the Tucson Symphony back in 2009. He's composed a four-part work entitled Conversations with Nijinsky that was recorded by the San Francisco Ballet Orchestra and nominated for Grammy and Best Composition category back in 2017. He's written an opera. He's written numerous chamber music pieces and has a violin concerto that was commissioned by the Nashville Symphony to be premiered next May 2025. He was also in a band called Winger. I want you to listen to this with an open mind. Kip has a lot of incredibly interesting things to say.
By the way, I just want to do this little disclaimer. Everything about you is for real. Like, I came and took a lesson from you. You remember that? I don't know what year that was, but so I'll backtrack to before that. I studied early on. I was in a band with my brothers when I was 9 or 10. Even before that, I played my first professional gig actually when I was 8, and we were playing like Grand Funk and Led Zeppelin and all that stuff. And I was really into the prog bands of the 70s, like Jethro Tull and Yes and all that stuff. And I was thinking, what are they doing? You know, something a little more, you know. So I studied classical guitar when I was 16 and got really into Baroque music and 7 hours a day and all that. And very early on was like, man, practicing this much is not for me. You know, I was all about the writing. I was into karate and stuff, so I was kind of athletic, stretched out and stuff. And I had a girlfriend that wanted to take ballet, and none of her girlfriends would take ballet with her. And I was like, I'll do it. I'm up for, you know, whatever. So we go in to the ballet studio, and out of the ballet studio is like Rachmaninoff and Stravinsky and Tchaikovsky and Debussy and Ravel. And I was like, whoa, what's this about? And so I got really into it. And I was actually pretty good at ballet. And she was not very good and quit. And I just stayed in it. And I got in a company. And because I was in Colorado and there was like recruiting men in ballet back then was real like rare. And but it was the music. I kept going, oh my God, listen to this music, this music, this music. And so dance and music has always been kind of connected for me. And I started kind of studying a little bit, but I didn't know how to study. That was the trick. I didn't know how to study and what to study. So, and I always thought, well, it's out of reach for me. I'd love to be an orchestral composer, but it's a dream too far away. And so I always listened.
I'd like to take a second to talk to you about this channel. This is actually Rick Beato 2. I've had it since the beginning of my main channel, and many of you are not subscribed. As a matter of fact, 87% of the people that watch this channel regularly are not subscribed. So I encourage you to hit the subscribe button on this channel and on my main channel. This will help me get even more of my dream guests and help continue to grow both channels. Thank you.
The way it really happened for me was, well, I moved to New York when I was 22, waiting tables, and I took some composition lessons from a cat named Edgar Grana. And it was an interesting circle of friends then, because Edgar did a little bit with David Sanborn. And there was a little circle of people. It was because I was working with the producer, Bo Hill, then.
Yes.
As a kind of an assistant. He was like, he produced my brothers and my band, and I kind of followed him to New York. But I was also taking ballet and learning a little bit of composition stuff. Edgar was like, well, go study the string quartet by Debussy. And he had me do an analysis of Elgar theme and variations.
Yeah.
And I was really, that's when I really was like, oh my God, this is incredible. Like what, you know, and I was really getting it, you know. But I was still too busy doing other stuff to really like dig in. And I dropped out of high school, man.
Okay.
You know, so I didn't really.
I think I knew that. Yeah.
I didn't understand like how to study.
Right.
You know, stuff started taking off for me on the other side. I got into Alice Cooper.
Right.
And I kept studying stuff, kind of, but not knowing what to do. And then got an album deal with Winger. Kept listening to this. This is all about the classical thing, right? So then when grunge hit,
yep,
and all the stuff that happened to me happened, we lost everything. Living,
which actually happened, not just happened to you, but happened to pretty much all the 80s bands.
Yeah, I always liken it to the high schoolers liked Elvis, and then the junior high was like, we want our own band. So we liked the Beatles, and then Led Zeppelin, and then Bee Gees, and then punk. And it happened to the 80s. Grunge, it was inevitable.
Right.
You know, so I got singled out in some other stuff, and I was in Santa Fe totally without a gig, basically.
Yeah.
And then my first wife passed away in a car wreck, which was even more brutal. So I was totally in oblivion going, what's happening here? And I thought to myself, you know what? I'm going to learn how to compose. It was at that rock bottom point where I thought, hey, man, I got nothing to lose here, man. I don't care if anybody ever plays anything of mine. I'm just going to go learn how to do this. So I went to University of New Mexico. Found a composition teacher named Richard Herman, who introduced me to post-tonal music, put me through counterpoint. And then a couple years later, I moved to Nashville and heard a piece of music at Blair School of Music,
yep,
by a composer named Michael Curick. And I was like, I want to write like that. And he was right over there. So I went over and just introduced myself and said, hey, I want to study with you.
And Blair School's at Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I entered the adult extension program at Blair and studied with Michael for a while, where I wrote the first movement to the ballet I did, Ghosts. And he introduced me to a fellow by the name of Richard Danielpour, mm-hmm, who's a major American composer. And he listened to Ghosts, and we hit it off. Him and I hit it off, man. We went to dinner and just was like, you're my brother from another mother, man. But that was it. I didn't hear anything. It was like, cool. He said some things about my piece and stuff. And then 2 months later, he called me up and said, you should come to New York and study with me. And he said, so here's the deal. 2-hour lesson once a month. You have to study with me minimum for a year. And I want the full-on commitment. I'm like, I'm in. So I flew to New York once a month for longer than that. I just took a lesson from him last month in LA, because he's now at UCLA. And so we became fast friends. But I wrote the piece that I got nominated for under him, Conversations with Dijinsky. So.
Okay, he got nominated for, talk about this.
So in 2017, I got nominated for a Grammy in Contemporary Classical Composition, which was surreal. I mean, I totally wasn't expecting it, and it came completely out of nowhere, and it was like, I mean, I'm not going to kid you, man. It was because, you know, I've taken some shit in my career, and it was just kind of like, okay, that set the record straight, you know, in a good way, you know, because I was just writing because I love it, you know.
Kip, you're a serious musician. You've had a whole nother career since Winger. I mean, you still do. You still play with the band,
yeah,
and are making records, but you have this other side of you that you spend just as much time, probably more time on.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm panicking right now because I'm writing a violin concerto for Nashville Symphony. I'm looking at my tour schedule and I'm going, I'm not going to get this done. But yeah, in general, it took me a year to write my first symphony, which they premiered last March, about a year and a half to write a piece.
It's like the end of last March or so, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I spend most of the time. But you know what? What's funny is I just spend most of the time here. I can't really sit at an instrument very long anymore. I don't know if you noticed that. Because you'll sit at an instrument and it will distract you.
Yeah.
You know.
Sit at instruments anymore. Just kidding.
Yeah.
So when you are working on
a piece, if you have a commission, how much time do you allot per day? What does your work day look like? Or if you're writing for yourself, you're writing something, you're writing a, like, orchestral
piece.
It's
really interesting. I'm still trying to find my zen there, dude. You know?
When you get up in the morning and write first thing, usually?
The first thing I do is get up and go to the gym.
There you go.
I can't function if I don't go to the gym anymore, man. Because the main thing is getting the blood going. And you'll hear all these workout things about, oh, cardio sucks and working and all this stuff. And I totally disagree. Like, I need to get on the treadmill for 30 minutes just to get the brain going.
Yeah.
You know, that's what the biggest thing I've noticed. So that's the first thing. And then I come down and I try to work relatively early because I'm at 61. Like, I don't have the stamina anymore. I mean, I'm just like, 7 o'clock rolls around. I used to work late into the night. I mean, I know you know, same with you, you know, 2 and 3 in the morning and you're just like getting going, you know, and I'm like 7 o'clock and I'm cooked, man, you know? So I need to work early and, you know, like 11 to 4 is a good kind of regime. And it's difficult because I'm on the road all the time. But when I'm, you know, I heard somebody say one time, and I wish I could remember who it was, but, you know, interruption is the destroyer of creativity, man, mm-hmm. You know. So I try to just keep a safe space to work from, like, ideally about 11. I can't really do anything before then because I just need to get the blood going. You know?
So who's going to play this violin concerto? Is there a violinist in mind?
So it was commissioned for the Concertmaster of Nashville Symphony.
Okay.
And it's due, like, by the end of the year. They're going to do it in the 24-25 season. And they're actually, it was a very huge compliment, actually. They played Nijinsky. Mm-hmm. And what was cool about it is the conductor, who's amazing, Giancarlo Guerrero, heard conversations with Nijinsky, and he brought me in to play it. And at the talks before the concert, he had me get up and talk about the piece and all this stuff. And my big thing was always like, okay, if I'm going to learn how to do this, I'm going to be able to speak their language. I'm not going to be the rock guy that comes in and goes, could you just play it, like, you know, kind of blue, you know, like I wanted to know all the stuff, right?
Right.
And he was kind of like, okay, if you want to come in here, you have to know all the stuff.
Yeah.
You know? And it was very cool because there's this incredible mutual respect there. But then at the pre-show talk, he goes, I'm not even to tell you, I was a huge Winger fan and Rod Morgenstern's amazing, you know? So that was really funny, but then they commissioned me for an album, which was really cool. Like the symphony and the violin concerto, they was going to be on Naxos Records with an album of my stuff. So that was
okay. I want to back up a minute. Let's talk about some of your favorite works of other people, of composers that you've studied, that people should know if they want to get into contemporary music, music of the 20th century into the 21st century. Who are some composers that you
living?
No. Stravinsky, you know, who are people that you really look up to?
It's funny that you say that because I've got a classical playlist that I've been meaning to publish for people that want to, like, get into it. My entree into it was impressionistic. Mm-hmm. I mean, most people that don't know about classical music, immediately if they hear Debussy or Ravel, they're going to like it.
Yeah.
You know? But then for me, it goes from, and really for me, like, anything I listen to starts there.
Right.
I don't love anything before that except a few composers. And Les Six, the six French composers, I couldn't name them all right now, but one of them was Honegger.
Mm-hmm.
And his music resonated with me more than almost anyone. Like his scores, when I would look at his scores, it was like, you remember Spencer's books, right?
Yeah.
So you go into Spencer's books and you see the black light poster and you stare at it for a minute and it turns 3D.
you have to be 60 years old to know about Spencer's.
So I see his scores and they turn 3D. I'm like, this is exactly, I totally get this. So right. he's big for me. But some contemporary guys that everyone should check out, Richard Daniel Poor, the guy I study with, his harmonic sensibilities are unbelievable. Aaron Kernis.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are alive right now. They're alive and well and cooking. John Corigliano.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Stravinsky, of course.
Yep.
But I really am And it changes. It always keeps evolving.
No, I mean, were you into Bartok? Were you into Berg? Were you into
Webern?
Were you into
Schoenberg? I was just about to say Berg.
Okay.
And it's what's great about you is we can have this conversation. Like, you could go talk about Grand Funk, and you could talk about this. So it's awesome.
Kip used to say to me, why are you wasting your time producing rock bands? You need to get into serious music and doing serious stuff.
Yeah, well, you're capable. So... Volzek by Berg.
Yeah.
Berg was the only one, in my opinion, who could really, really make Atonal beautiful.
Yes.
He really made it beautiful. Webern, too, in a way, but, and a lot of people don't know this, but they give Schoenberg
yeah.
credit for atonalism, but to my understanding, from what I've studied, is that it was actually Webern who accidentally fell upon it. And Schoenberg was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then they, you know, kind of started developing it together. But yeah, Concerto for Orchestra, and
yep.
Unbelievable. You know, it goes on and on and on and on. But the harmonic functions that are happening in that kind of music, I'm way more drawn to that than if you go back. But, I mean, if you go back to certain older pieces from older composers like Tchaikovsky, you can't get better melodies.
Right.
And so the thing is that in contemporary music, I think the thing that turns a lot of people off is that they're not focused on melodies and stuff. They're really doing these techniques that may actually not sound so great in some cases, and they kind of turn people off. And like, where's the beef, you know? And so actually what I try to do is take a lot of that dissonance and write really, you know, solid melodies over them, and I'm trying to find a way to marry those two worlds. But you know, Shostakovich does this unbelievably
Prokofiev.
Well. And Prokofiev, I was going to say it changes for what you're studying or what you're writing. It's like I'm writing this violin thing, and it's like, why should I write a violin concerto? You know, I would have never even thought of it, but the concertmaster was like, hey, I want him to write this for me, and it was a great honor for me. But when I thought about it, it was like panic, you know, seriously, like, think of all the things that come before it. It's like what you have to live up to. And that in itself is crippling, you know. So you think, well, what do I have to bring to this? So I thought, well, what I have to bring is I've been working with Reb Beach in the studio for 30 years. So I put some guitar solo, you know, on the violin, a little bit of that. And we worked a lot on his solos. Like, I've witnessed so many of the solos. I started writing the violin concerto thinking, well, wait a minute. I've been working with this virtuoso sure. guitar player
That's
all
right.
this time. And so I've been trying to apply a little bit of that. But, dude, it's always like, you know, you've written plenty of songs to know that when you go down a rabbit hole and all of a sudden you come to a dead end and you're like, what do I do? That's why I went and saw Richard last month in California, is because I'm stuck on the second movement of this piece. Like, what do I do, man? Because I had all these nice chords to this really nice melody, and it was sounding a little bit more like Downton Abbey TV theme, you know? And he's like, no, you need harmony, dude. And it was amazing to witness the lesson, because I have a recording of it. I should play it for you. He just goes, no, okay, what's the melody? And I know, because I don't write a lot by hand. I do it a lot in the computer.
Yeah.
He writes everything by hand, but that's so old school. I'm too slow for that. And so
what do you use, Sibelius, or use Finale? You use Sibelius.
Sibelius. So I wrote it out by hand because I knew he'd be like, huh. And he grabs the melody and goes, no, you need way more like dark melody. So he grabs like a major minor chord in fourth inversion and just starts pounding this out. Put this in the horns, you know. And he's like, he starts doing this thing, and it was like, boom, just cracked me open, man. It was like I walked out of there going, okay, I know what to do. It's amazing.
So I just want to back up a second. You played bass with Alice Cooper. You played bass in your band. But you're an excellent guitar player. So you played guitar your whole life, right? You started on guitar probably.
Except I couldn't play a lead to save my life.
Yeah, but you're such a great rhythm player and an amazing finger-picking player.
That comes from all those classical guitar things.
Yeah, and you have your fake nails and everything.
Yeah, that's when it's falling off. But yeah, I do, yeah. I can't. It's funny because when I do my solo acoustic thing, I have to get them on, and then I want to go back and work at the piano, and it's like I tear them off, and then I get them on and tear them off.
So I saw you play your 12 string, and it blew me away, the arrangements that you had, that you were playing. I was stunned.
Thanks.
And I came up and I talked to you after sound check at the Cotton Club. It was like 2002, something like that.
That's nice. Thank you.
And I told all my friends about it. I said, you can't believe it. And I came back to the show. I watched a show, and I was just knocked out. I mean, I always thought you were one of the best singers that I ever heard.
Oh, thanks.
But then these arrangements of your songs were nothing like your songs. It sounded like modern classical music played on a 12-string with you singing over it.
Yeah. It was all an evolution out of not having a gig, to be honest with
right.
you. Like, when I put my first solo album out in 94, like, I couldn't get a gig, so I did a Borders bookstore tour, about 40 Borders bookstore tours, 4 p.m., and nobody was there, like 10 people. And so I'd just go, and they'd be like, hey, man, play Blind Revolution, man. I'm like, oh, I don't know how to do that. Let's see. And I just developed them from there, you know. It took years to do that, years. You know, and
why the 12 string, though?
It just gives it a little bit more, you know. It's just a little bit more girth. You could just work with the higher octave. You can get more voicings out of it. Just a little bit more of that kind of.
Can't play a little bit more of that.
That's an instrumental song. I can easily do that.
Okay.
Asked me about why 12 string. It was because I was doing these gigs myself, and the 6 string just didn't have a big enough sound. And
yeah.
So most people know me for my green guitar, which is not a true acoustic guitar. I plug it in, I put it through a Boss compressor,
yep.
And I tell the sound man to crank the low end. Like,
it sounds massive.
Well, they always look at me like, oh yeah, right, dude, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, trust me. Turn the 50 hertz up 20 dB.
Yeah.
So when I whack it, it's like a kick drum.
Yes.
You know? And they're like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. And I'm like, trust me. Now I carry a percussionist, so we have a little bit of extra stuff going on. But it was just born out of necessity, man. I was like, okay, how am I gonna get a gig? So I gotta learn all this stuff and learn how to play it and figure out how to play these. And my classical guitar training really came in handy to try to voice some of the stuff, you know. If I was John Travolta when disco sucked, I would have had all those royalties on Grease, and I would have gotten my plane and said, I'm out of here to the Bahamas.
How did you start coming up with the arrangements, though, for these songs initially? All the arrangements of the Winger songs for solo 12 string. Tuning down, you've always tuned down with a 12 string.
Well, like that's what's cool. That's the other thing about my green guitar. I tuned down to C just because I wanted to, I didn't want to be singing all that stuff because we tuned the albums, the first two albums were E flat, and then the pull was tuned to D. And everything
right.
I've done since then is D. But I tuned to C to just make it one more,
Right. it sounds incredibly full. I love the sound of the...
To get that, that green guitar just rocks. I mean, it's a stock Alvarez that I had somebody, paint it one day. But people are like, oh my God, what is that? It's just a hand-painted stock Alvarez guitar with regular pickups. I mean, no frills. I use light gauge strings on it, too.
Okay.
Then I can really dig into the...
What were your singing influences as a rock singer?
That's an excellent question, man, because I never considered myself to be a lead singer. Seriously.
You're such a great singer.
Because I grew up with my brothers, and we all sang.
And you just harmonized, right? Was any of you the lead singer?
We would trade.
Okay.
But when we got into Winger, it was Reb, I was like, okay, who's going to sing this stuff? Well, I guess I am, because I can sing the range, And... And when we got our first gig was with Scorpions.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know how to be a lead
frontman.
When
you were with Alice Cooper, were you doing background
vocals? Backgrounds, yeah. Now, that's probably why I got hired, because I can sing all that high stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But when we did the band, we got out Minneapolis opening for the Scorpions, and I was like, you know, I didn't know how to front a band. I was like I was at breakfast, like, okay, give me a bran muffin, side of grapefruit, you know. And then I watched Klaus Meine for 2-3 shows, and like, you know, you get a clue, man. Getting back to your question, I mean, it was difficult for me because I could never do like the bluesy riffs and stuff. So if like you listen to Paul Rodgers or Coverdale, I'd be like, God, these guys are great. But I could never get those in my throat. I worked a year on a Coverdale lick, and finally I could sing it. But my voice was more like Paul Stanley, you know, just balls out. And when I, it really kicks in when I'm way up there.
Yeah.
It's not so distinct.
Is that a falsetto, or is that, what is that?
I've tried to, because I teach voice.
I know. You're a great vocal teacher. Is that a head voice or something? What do you call that?
It is, but you have to do this weird squeezing thing with your throat. And so it is a head voice. It's almost like throwing your voice. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, how's it going? Hey! You know, and you have to squeeze just a little bit to get that weird distortion in there, man. And, you know, it takes its toll after a while. And, you know, Paul, we toured with those guys, and he was on fire on the Hot in the Shade tour. Mm-hmm. I mean, unbelievable. You know, I kind of stole some stuff from him, but I, you know, just basic rock singing. I mean, when I did my solo stuff, I was trying to do imitation of other people. Now I just do my thing.
Right.
You know, but when you're young and you're getting going, it's like, well, and I did this with writing too. When you're stuck on an idea, it's like, what would Sting do, or what would Gabriel do, or what would what would they do in here? But that's a really good question. No one ever asked me that question, actually. I don't really know who I aspire to. Because
I mean, you liked singers like Robert Plant, I'm sure. You liked, what about the Beatles? Lennon and McCartney and George Harrison? I mean, you know.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, McCartney, like, it's just so unique. And like, I mean, of course, we all tried to sing with an English accent when we were kids. But Robert Plant's incredible. But like I say, I never considered myself a lead singer until like the third album. We did Pull. I finally was like, okay, this is what lead singing is all about, you know. And I was just like the perpetual student, man. It was like, okay, I'm going to study this. How do I do this? And how do I do that? I'm big on mentors, you know. Find a mentor that kicks your ass in any situation that you want to try. So I'd find a good singer and find a good composition teacher, find a, you know, whoever it was that I was trying to do, to learn all that stuff. That's why I'm one of those guys that can do several different things and do them well enough to get by, you know.
It pains me that people ask you the same dumb questions at interviews and that they don't care that you're a really serious musician. That's always bugged me that people, you know, that it's hard to change what people's impressions are of you. That's the most difficult thing.
Thank you.
And I, you know, this is one of the things that why I wanted you to come here and talk and not talk about the same stupid things that you get asked all the time.
We've known each other a long time, so you know, you get it. And you get a lot of things more than most people, so I really appreciate that.
Well, you made me sit in with Winger. It's the last time that I played live, actually, on a real stage. It was 2012, and Kip calls me up, and he says, he's like, hey, what are you doing tonight? We're playing here. I said, yeah, I was going to come down. Well, I want you to come down and sit in. I was like, no, I don't sit in, man. And he's like, no, you're going to come and sit in. I said, no, I don't sit in. He says, yes, you are. And I said, well, what
is... put a guitar on him. He
says, what are we playing? He goes, Helter Skelter. And I said, all right. And he goes, well, be there 15 minutes so we can run over. I said, I already know how to play Helter Skelter. He said, just be there 15 minutes early. So I go back there and Reb handed me his guitar. I'd never met Reb or Rod before in person. I've seen you guys play and everything. And I actually sat in with you. There is a recording. My old assistant Ken videoed me on stage. I can't find it. I will find it. It's on one of my old computers, and I'm gonna put it up on Instagram.
Oh, you got to put it up. Yeah.
That's awesome. So I really appreciate that.
We played Helter Skelter.
We did. We played Helter Skelter. Yeah.
I was thinking we played Ain't Talking About Love, but it was Helter Skelter.
No, I would have played either one, but you forced me to do that.
Yeah, it was fun. That was a blast.
Kip, can I get you to play another song?
I can try, yeah, sure. Yeah. Try to play this one that I can't play.
Okay.
I totally can't play it, and I'll let you guys go. But...
Woman, never before, without a word, I hear so.
To once again thank Kip for being my guest today. Leave a comment, hit the subscribe button. Thanks for watching.